Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim's discipline should be commended. The crazy has nothing to do with football. So if you're a Jets fan, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If not, let's just get to the politics. Let's move to the good martini and the fact that Bo Bergdahl this morning pleaded guilty to desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. For those a little fuzzy on the Bergdahl story, he was an American soldier who was released by the Taliban in 2014 in exchange for five very high-level figures that we were holding at Guantanamo Bay. The Obama administration extolled Bergdahl as kind of a recruiting poster model soldier, and it turns out he was anything but that. At a court-martial, he decided not to take it to court. His argument in an interview that was aired by ABC in recent days suggested he thought he couldn't get a fair trial because of all the things candidate Donald Trump said about him on the campaign trail last year. Could also be the evidence, Jim. I think that might be a factor here as well. This now goes to sentencing, and I think the folks who are hoping for a life sentence are probably going to be disappointed. I'm assuming at this point he'll get something, and given the number of lives lost by people looking for him who thought he was missing and not deserting, there definitely needs to be some serious punishment here.
Indeed, and you know, I think it's kind of good to see Bo Bergdahl in the news again, just as a reminder that, you know, does the current administration have problems? Heck yes. Are there good reasons for the for them to get bad, you know, criticism and bad coverage and things like that? Sure. But as the Obama administration recedes into history, you hear some people saying, ah, they never did anything like this. And ah, at least the people could trust the Obama administration. It was utter nonsense for those of us who actually have clear memories of this time. And I think the Bo Bergdahl trade was a really good example of this, because not merely the infamous Susan Rice comment that he had served with honor and distinction. No, he hadn't. No. A good follow-up to her comments about Benghazi. It is worth noting that why did the U.S. pursue that deal for Bergdahl's release? Was it because we wanted to get our guy back? Yes, but also he was driven in large part by the Obama administration's pledge to close Guantanamo Bay, that they were absolutely determined to get every single person in there transferred to some other country as quickly as possible in order to keep the president's pledge. Now, they didn't manage to do that, but a whole bunch of them there. This was a way to get five of, if not the worst of the worst, then, you know, among the worst, guys who had really infamous records of brutality and violence and attempting to kill Americans. My lone appearance on the Bill Maher program was shortly after the deal. And I remember Bill Maher's opening monologue saying, oh, my goodness, you listen to the Republicans. They talk as if these guys have superpowers. Oh, no, if we release them. Well, they're Taliban, right? Nobody's saying that they have superpowers. It doesn't mean they have to be, you know, that this makes them not dangerous people, right? I mean, the idea is that they are dangerous people. And they've committed horrific crimes. Of course, you want people like this behind bars. No, but don't worry, the Qataris are going to keep them under wraps and all that kind of stuff. And of course, within a couple of months, we'd completely lost track of them. And they may, for all we know, they may be rejoining the effort to kill Americans and things like that. And all of this done in exchange. Look, for a five-for-one deal is bad rates as is. Now, all of a sudden, I'm sounding like Trump saying we could negotiate a better deal. But in addition to that, you have this this White House effort to build up Bo Bergdahl into this heroic figure that he simply wasn't. And this is why, you know, this is what obscures whether, you know, is this deal worthwhile? Well, we can't really have a good discussion about it if we're not willing to be honest about it. The White House was committed to a narrative that was contrary to the facts, and they would not acknowledge those inconvenient facts. So it is good that, you know, that Bo Bergdahl is being held accountable, that this isn't being swept under the rug. And I think it is worth, you know, if and when Bo Bergdahl gets sentenced, it is worth putting some harder questions to President Obama and Susan Rice and the rest of the team who said, you know, you did trade five dangerous criminals for one American who had deserted his troops and risked the lives of his fellow countrymen. So I doubt we'll ever get that kind of hard-hitting questions of either one of those figures. But it is worth reminding there when people ask, why did America turn to Donald Trump? Why were they so cynical about government? Why did they not care about Trump lying? Look, in part because the previous administration lied to them with impunity for quite a few years.
Absolutely right. Yeah, this is the same administration, same Secretary of State also that negotiated the Iran nuclear deal and the Paris climate deal. So getting fleeced on the Bergdahl deal didn't surprise a whole lot of people who were familiar with the track record there. All right, let's move on to the bad martini now. And speaking of the war on terror, the situation in Iraq, of course, has been a problem for a long time, particularly since we left and ISIS rose up. And now we're back in there in some capacity, mainly assisting the Kurds and the Iraqi forces in driving ISIS into a smaller and smaller area. We got them out of Mosul. Things around Raqqa are getting very tight. They're basically running out of real estate. So you would think we're on the verge of things getting a whole lot better in Iraq. Not happening. The sectarian problems that exist there are not going away. And as Matt Lauer of NBC reports, we have two different sets of allies there, at least for us, the Kurds and the Iraqi forces, now fighting each other over control of Kirkuk in the north.
Iraqi federal forces have launched a major operation that's aimed at driving Kurdish forces from the disputed city of Kirkuk. Troops have not yet entered that city, but residents reported hearing what sounds like shelling and rocket fire. Kurdish forces took control of Kirkuk back in 2014 when ISIS swept across northern Iraq and the country's armed forces crumbled. Iraq has since demanded that the city be handed back to federal control. Tensions have escalated since the Kurds voted for independence in a non-binding referendum last month. The conflict puts the United States in a difficult position because both the Iraqi army and those Kurdish forces are our allies in the fight against ISIS.
Jim, this is just so discouraging. Not surprising, but completely discouraging because, of course, these groups have hated each other for a long time. But when you look at the heroism of the Peshmerga and the Kurdish fighters basically being the last line of defense against the advance of ISIS in a lot of different parts of northern Iraq, to have this immediate response, yes, I know there was the referendum. Yes, I know the Kurds would love to have their independence here. Hopefully that could be negotiated somehow or another. But to have these guys immediately at each other's throats physically is just disheartening and makes you wonder if there can ever be stability there. My guess is probably there can't.
Now, Greg, I'm reminded of a routine by the comedian Chris Rock, which the punchline was a variation of, I'm not saying you should have done it, but I understand. The way I feel about isolationists right now, I don't believe that we can become Fortress America. I don't believe that we can disengage from the rest of the world. I don't believe that we can have these, dumpster fires of ethnic and sectarian and religious conflicts burn out of control and not think that none of those troubles will end up on our doorstep. But at times like this, Greg, I understand where you're coming from, isolationists. I can understand this feeling of this region of the world is never going to get fixed. They are never going to get better. They never slow down or stop or take a breather from the conflict. It's easy to have great sympathy for the Kurds. They have been one of our, in a region where we've had few consistent allies. They have generally run a functioning state, a comparably free state, and been our ally against Islamist and extremist groups of almost every stripe. Having said that, when they held this referendum, the United States did not say full speed ahead, guys, because we knew there'd be a reaction probably like this. So the Iraqi government would see it as being particularly provocative and the first step on declaring independence, even though they said the referendum was non-binding. I remember saying at the time, well, here comes Kurd exit. And this was going to be a big deal. And it did not get an enormous amount of attention in the U.S. press. Well, now we see why it should have gotten more. I know the U.S. was doing its part to try to tell the Kurds to say, hey, guys, let's not throw any gasoline on the fire here. Now it appears to be too late. And, it's worth noting, like, ISIS has been, dealt some pretty serious defeats, but they're not gone yet, guys. The fight is not over. Against the one group that almost everybody in the region agreed was a menace and was bloodthirsty and was brutal and a threat to everybody else. Sad to say, it's possible that Iraq may, end up finally getting rid of ISIS only to plunge into another round of civil war. Because, look, that region hasn't had a lot of bloody civil wars lately. Now, has it, Greg?
All right. Let's move on to our crazy martini now. And I'd love to say this one's less depressing, but no, it's depressing. Newsweek magazine. The biggest surprise here to some folks, Jim, might be that Newsweek still exists. I'm not even sure that they do a print copy. Maybe they do. I haven't seen one in a long time. But they do still have an online presence at the very least. And apparently they're not doing well there either, because they're getting more and more bizarre in their effort to attract attention. Last week, just as the Harvey Weinstein story was starting to reach full peak, Newsweek decides it's a really good idea to get some analysis on why Congress hasn't been very effective so far this year by interviewing former House Speaker Dennis Hastert, who earlier this year was released from prison. He was officially convicted and sentenced on financial issues, but it was all stemming from the fact that he molested a bunch of kids back when he was a teacher in Illinois a number of decades ago. So to have him on record at all is kind of appalling, and to have it in the context of what else was going on in the news was even more bizarre. And now here's the latest one from Newsweek magazine. Donald Trump to speak at hate groups annual event, a first for a president. And if you didn't know what the event was, you might think, whoa, is this some sort of David Duke or Richard Spencer thing? What is Trump thinking? No, it's the Value Voters Summit, sponsored by the Family Research Council. And since the Southern Poverty Law Center has described anyone who is not all aboard the LGBT agenda as a hate group and full of bigotry, now we have this headline, Trump speaking at hate groups annual event. So, Jim, I can't imagine why the mainstream media thinks that we have a problem with them over how they characterize the news.
Newsweek is technically still around. It is one of those magazines where, I don't know about you, I always see the headline and I always feel like they're trying too hard, just kind of desperately trying to grab your attention and say, please buy me. Obama on the cover with the headline, The Second Coming. You get the idea. So on these stories, first of all, Hastert, like you want to talk about like normalizing sex abuse, right? Do you want to talk about normalizing abnormal behavior? Greg, this is not light years away from writing a generic profile of Harvey Weinstein and his movie production right now. Dennis Hastert, yes, he was former Speaker of the House, but I don't know if that's what I want to say. This is what he should be known for, right? Once you've done things like that, that's not the sort of thing you can scrub off, or you want to say, oh, well, let's compartmentalize this. Let's put this thing he did a while ago over here, but let's really say, how can we make the House work better? By the way, those of us who covered Dennis Hastert may know it was not – I don't remember that being a conveyor belt of major and impressive legislation during those years. It's just the overall general easiness with which the term hate group gets thrown around and is rather revealing, I think. Because, look, there was a guy who shot up the offices of the Family Research Council not too long ago, a couple of years back, and he was going to, he planned on shooting as many people as possible, and he wanted to stuff Chick-fil-A into their mouths of the dead bodies. I'm not making that detail up. And when they talked to the shooter, it was very clear he did this because of the Southern Poverty Law Center. So the Southern Poverty Law Center, which allegedly is standing up against violence and standing up against these extremist groups, has at least in one case encouraged violence. In one case, given the green light to someone to say, oh, these are bad people, the world would be better with them dead because they're a hate group. But they're not. You can agree with the Family Research Council and Value Voters Summit, or you can disagree with them. It's a free country. You're allowed to do that. But believing that, I don't believe that marriage is between a man and a woman puts you on the moral equivalent of the Klan, right? If you hold true to that biblical standard, you're not burning a cross on somebody's lawn. You're not a threat or a menace to anybody. There is still a freedom of thought in this country. At least I thought there was. And groups like Newsweek blurring this line, I assume in a desperate attempt to get clicks or headlines or newsstand sales. Who am I kidding? There's no such thing as newsstand sales anyway. I think does real damage to our public discourse because it then makes you say, oh, your neighbor who happens to disagree with gay marriage or something like that, well, they're on the level of a Klansman. And thus you would never have to interact. And then you know what happens to you, Greg, in a circumstance like that? You turn into Jimmy Kimmel, who basically just announced this weekend he doesn't care if Republicans stop watching his show. He doesn't think he has much to say to them anyway.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.